a chunk over here, and in some cases they transport them. One case they transport it to a central distributing point, fruit stand, if you will. But the lots are actually fairly scattered around. But I would think that you have to make provision for those people and for part-time farmers. You don't want to say that just because you're a part-time farmer that you don't deserve EFU classification, if that's what you need. And I just see that we're being just nickel and dimed here and there, every little thing. And in our area, I think that right now we have EFU. And as this bill stands today, I wouldn't be surprised if our neighbors, some of our farming neighbors who also have EFU, could come along and be class marginal. And once they go marginal, pretty soon we start to look marginal. And that takes away our rights to improve what we have.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Davis.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Robert Davis, owner of St. Helens Golf Course, and I'm president of the Oregon Golf Course Owners Association, and I'm here to urge you not to remove golf courses as a conditional use on EFU land. Basically, what I want to do is just give you some statistics, but first I'd like to read you from the latest National Golf Foundation newsletter, a column by Mr. Joe Much, Director of Field Services. Oregon is the home of one golf course, or 18-hole equivalent, for every 25,380 of its residents, compared to Michigan's 1 to 17,350 ratio, which is somewhat less favorable than the national average. More alarming for the state's legends of active year-round golfers has been a virtual standstill in new golf course construction the past few years. Always a popular playground for tourists, the rain-washed Beaver State more recently has been known for tight litter laws, stringent land use policies, anti-pollution fervor, and a position that visitors are welcome so long as they do not linger, that is, set up residence. Now some of that is changing in the ailing economy. State government-inspired promotion today not only invites visitors, but suggests that they come back with their belongings, including their industries, businesses, families, furniture, and presumably golf clubs. We feel that tourism is going to be a growth industry in the state. It is now, for that matter. And to give you an idea of how golf as a recreation industry has grown, my golf course was built on a dairy by the farm owners in 1962, 21 years ago. And quoting from this publication from the National Golf Foundation, it's golf facilities in the United States, they estimate the number of golfers increased between 62 and 82, 156%. The number of rounds played increased 286%. 2 months ago, U.S. News and World Report had a population projection by state for the United States. They showed Oregon projecting a growth of 71% in population by the year 2000. Right now, we apparently don't quite have enough golf courses for the population we have. If the population grows 71%, that's going to show a requirement for more golf courses. Also, if we're going to build a tourist industry, there are a lot of tourists that come through that like to play golf. We feel that some golf courses will be built on exclusive farm use land and that the conditional use process provides adequate protection. And that's all I have to say. Do you have any?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Priestley.
As you were giving those percentages, I wondered, did you have any kind of, do you have any figures?
Yes, sir.
How many thousands of dollars are spent in golf in Oregon or something? Percentages I'm a little skeptical of.
Okay, I took those percentages from actual numbers. They have a ratio of golf courses by population by states. That's where the ratio of 25,000 people per 18-hole golf course in the state came from.
What was the net? What was the golf gross golf revenues of the golf courses in Oregon in '82 or something like that? You know that?
I just don't know what that would be.
It's hard for me to perceive of these percentages if it's based on a small base.
Yeah.
You apparently you base some of your testimony on the tourist industry. And
yes, sir.
I think we're all interested in that, but when we looked at the sales tax figures, I think something like 4% of the sales tax would be paid by a tourist. And so I suspect that they're making 4% of the expenditures on golf courses. Is that about right? Or do you think that a tourist disproportionately plays golf and so maybe would be higher? That's what you seem to allege, and I wondered if you could substantiate any of that.
We don't have a lot of destination resorts, golf course resorts in the states. The golfers that come through that I see at my golf course, for instance, are people that come into the state to visit relatives and are golfers. And also, for instance, next summer we have a retired group that travel. This year they're in California, of a travel club.
I'm not following this kind of. I know my mind only works. I go from the general to the specific,
okay.
And I wanted to get tied down to your general and go specific.
Yes, you're looking for.
How much money is spent here by tourists on golf?
I wish I knew. I really don't know.
What was your testimony in relation to tourists and golf courses and land use? I didn't understand that then. Say that again.
Okay, my testimony is that there will be an increased demand for golf courses. And we feel that if golf courses are removed as a conditional use on exclusive farm use land, it would restrict development of golf courses in the state. And we feel that there's enough flexibility and study under the conditional use process to protect farmland if golf courses are left in as a conditional use on farmland. That was my point.
But what was the reasoning based on tourism and whatever?
Because of the demand. There's going to be more demand for golf courses in the state. There's more demand now than there are golf courses, and we don't want to restrict the growth of golf courses in the state. We feel this would restrict the growth of golf courses in the state.
Representative Bradbury.
Right now, our state policy is to try to hang on to all the land possible to produce food and fiber. There will be increased population in this state, and the people have seen fit to support an idea that we not put all of the new houses on that farmland. I guess I need to hear from you why we should say that golf courses should take up productive farmland, but houses shouldn't. I just don't understand it. I'm sorry.
Yes.
You know, you're not growing crops either, so I don't understand.
No, my golf course, if it came down, could be converted back into cropland. I'm not destroying the land, covering it with houses and concrete. I have a clubhouse, and then I have 80 acres of open land that could very easily be turned back into a dairy or whatever was necessary to do so. So it stays as green, productive land. I'm a farmer. I grow grass. I have the same practices that a farmer has with pesticides and irrigation and every other practice. The only difference is that I have people walking on my pastures rather than animals. So the land is still there. It's not being destroyed. It's being put to a different use temporarily.
Appreciate that answer. That does help a little.
Thank you, sir.
I'd like the answer. I'm not a fan, of course, of sales tax representative, but I think we should set the record a little bit straight in that tourists, it's true, are only going to contribute 4% to the total sales tax picture if it's inaugurated. You have to understand that most of the tourists that come into the state are coming in campers and motorhomes and tents and all of this and are buying their groceries at the corner grocery store, which are not taxable items. So I think the contribution to tourism is significantly more than a 4% of the economy, even though the whole sales tax picture is only 4%.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Chu.
If I understand correctly, the Senate initially had you out of the FU zones,
yes.
Then put you back in.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're doing here is to argue that we retain the language as amended into the Senate draft and not go back to their original version?
Yes, sir. That's what I'm encouraging.
Okay.
Present law, which has always been. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Let's skip around just a little bit because some of these people came from quite a distance. Mike McCarthy from Parkdale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to speak. I didn't want to have to come back. I'm Mike McCarthy, and I raise pears, apples, peaches, and cattle and timber in Parkdale in the Hood River Valley. First, I'd like to say that agriculture is our number one industry in Oregon. If we're worried about Oregon's economy, let's protect it and promote agriculture. I'm in favor of the bill and agree with the concept of creating on creating marginal lands, but I believe we have to be very careful about how we define marginal lands and how we allocate marginal lands to prevent conversion of productive farmland and to prevent impacts on agriculture by non-farm dwellings. The problems of the non-farm dwelling are very real. In our area, we get a lot of objections to spraying, and as you know, spraying is an important practice in orchards, and many of the nearby residents object when we spray. When people first go in to apply for building permits for non-farm dwellings in our area, the first thing we hear at the Planning Commission or at some of these hearings is that they're looking forward to living in a farming area, that's why they're moving there, and that none of the practices that we do will bother them. After they've lived there for a while, they ask us why we spray so much, is it really necessary, why are they required to spray their own backyard trees as they are in a fruit district. And then after another year or so or a little time, then we get complaints and they don't want us to spray, they don't want the spray to drift over on their property, and sometimes they even ask us not to spray the last few rows that adjoin them so that the spray doesn't drift over on their property. So this is only an example of problems that occur with non-farm dwellings in farming areas. And I think it's important to attempt to prevent more non-farm dwellings in the farm zone, as this bill attempts to do. I'd also like to comment on the definitions that you have for defining marginal land. First, the part pertaining to small parcels, page 2, line 5, the 100-acre amount, I believe, is too small of an area. I think many of these small ownerships areas would exist throughout Oregon, and I think it would create many more non-farm dwellings. Before we just pass a bill with 100 acres in it, I think we should try to assess what the impact is. How many more actual non-farm dwellings will it create? Will it be just a few, or will every county have a real change in their current planning? I don't think we know that, and I think 100 acres is not nearly enough. I looked in my area to determine if I farmed in what could be defined as marginal land. I have a copy of a map of the tax assessor's lots, which demonstrates that right in the middle of the orchards above Parkdale in Hood River County, we have land which meets the criteria for parcelized marginal land. And if I or any of my neighbors in the adjoining area could demonstrate that part of our farm does not make a significant contribution to our farm, we could partition it off and create another parcel. If it's this easy to find qualifying marginal land in the middle of an orchard area, the test is too easy and means that there must be many thousands of acres in Oregon that would qualify. I recommend that you change the acreage requirement to 320. Pardon?
I'd like to ask the committee administrator if that previous statement he made is true according to the copy of the bill we're working from.
Cite the statement again, if you would, please.
Well, the statement he made was if his farm was not making a profit, then he could partialize the land off. As I read the bill, that's not what it says. If I were a non-farm person, I could, but if I'm a farm person, I can't. Is that right?
I am not an expert on this bill yet, but I believe that he is correct in that if a portion did not contribute to his farm, that he, and if it was adjacent to that parcelized portion, that he could parcelize that.
As I read the bill, that's the way it states. If a portion of my farm did not contribute, make a significant contribution to my farming enterprise, then I could partition it off. And it could become, along with these other parcels next to it, which meet the definition of located in an area of not less than 100 acres, of which at least 50% is composed of contiguous ownerships that are 20 acres or less in size. Well, I currently am adjacent to an area which meets that criteria.
Okay, maybe I'm working from a previous draft, but there was one in there that completely eliminated anyone who was a part of an existing farm, I think.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me for stopping you.
Would you tell us what parts of your farm do not make a significant contribution to your farm operation?
Well, I think that's the question, and that's the problem with it the way it's stated. Who's going to decide what parts make a significant contribution and what parts don't? At the present time, or at least the last 3 years, the price of Bartlett's for some Bartlett growers in the Hood River Valley has been $20 or less a ton. And at that price, you're losing $80 to $100 per ton per year. So any grower that happened to be sending his Bartlett's to that particular cannery that was receiving that price could easily have all of that land classified as not making a contribution. In addition, I have a significant portion of my place that contains a creek and some hilly land, which in economic terms makes no significant contribution to my farm.
Mr. Chair, make it follow.
Representative,
I personally would tend to think that your Bartlett's probably would qualify as a significant contribution, whether or not they maybe make a profit at the moment. But I'd like to follow up on your hilly land for just a second. Tell me a little more about that. Is there anything on it, just trees and brush, or is it planted in anything?
It's mostly brush.
Yeah. And you don't really believe that should be allowed to be built upon?
Well, the problem is, if it was built upon, it might not pose a significant problem to me, but the problem is that the way it's located in relationship to my orchard would make it very difficult for me to continue to do my farming operation. So, for example, if the previous owner had done this and sold it off, and there was a house there, and then I had purchased the property, and the owner on that place at present complained to me about some farm practices, I'd be in a very difficult position. So that would be a problem that it could pose.
One further question. Your hilly land that is trees and brush, basically, is that assessed at farm use values and tax value?
I'm not sure whether it is or not.
Mr. Hill?
How big's your operation? How many acres?
Well, in total, it's about 850 acres.
800.
So you, in several locations.
Currently, you grow considerably more than 20,000 a year.
Right.
Yeah. Do you deal with the books for your operation together? Do you deal with each separate parcel as one operation? Do you have separate sets?
They're separate books.
So one could well fall under the $20,000 gross test, where the others would pass that test. You could get more than $20,000 gross off of several of your parcels, but then
right
over here with a hilly land and your Bartlett's won't sell could fall below $20,000.
Right.
Okay, and that could be defined as
marginal lands and be.
I think that's an important point to make, because these farms, it seems typical farms like yours are kind of divided up. Not one classic family farm, but they're scattered around, and that complicates our considerations quite a bit. I'm from the city, I'm just learning about this stuff.
Okay.
So.
Mike, quite a bit of your testimony in regard to complaints from neighbors or possible complaints about your farming practices, and I'm sure you're aware that we did pass legislation last session on your right to farm, which protects you legally from all of your farming practices, dust, noise, herbicides, etc., etc., etc. I'm not quite following your point about if you did parcelize your hillside land, what problem are you going to have? Because that is protected by a law that they can't, they can complain, but they certainly can't do anything about it.
Well, that's one thing you mentioned right there. Does that protect me from my neighbors when they complain?
Yeah.
It doesn't. They still complain. I'm still bothered by it. It's still a nuisance. They still could possibly try to stop me. They still could possibly try to take some type of legal action and many other things. They could pass legislation that could restrict my activities.
Mr. Chairman?
Anything's possible in this life.
Right.
Representative Bradbury.
It's my understanding of the right to farm legislation that it would protect you from nuisance suits by your neighbors, but if you were, for example, spraying your orchard in an airplane and your neighbor built a house next to you and didn't want spray dripping on his house, there would be nothing through the right to farm that prevented him from being able to prevent you from dripping spray on his house. You would have to change your farming practices to ensure that you did not trespass, so to speak, on his property with your whatever you were doing. And there's no legislation that we've passed that changes that. I mean, you're still talking about changes in farm practices that might cost you money.
Okay, if there's no more questions, I'll go on. I think one problem with this 100-acre, 50%, 20-acre test is that in some areas it could multiply almost geometrically. For example, if you had 100 acres with four owners, a 40-acre parcel, a 20-acre parcel, a 20-acre parcel, and a 20-acre parcel, then conceivably the 40-acre owner could divide his land into two 20-acre parcels. That would give you five 20-acre parcels. Then this means that adjacent landowners could also then meet the test, possibly meet the test, and it would make it easier for them to parcelize their land. If you understand how that can go, it's possible that it could happen in many situations. And I just have one more comment then, and that's regard to the timber producing capability, which in this bill is now at 85 cubic feet per acre per year. In Hood River County, we're in sort of a transition zone between eastern type timber and western type timber. Some of our timber is pretty good timberland with above 85, and much of it is below 85. As an example, if you look at Hood River County private timberlands, 1% is between 120 to 164 cubic feet per acre per year. 10% is above the 85, is 85 to 119. 30% is between 50 and 84, and 40% is below 49. And then there's some very marginal land below that. But what this means is that only 11% of the timberland, private timberland in Hood River County, would fall into this classification. So the original 50 cubic feet per acre per year would be much more appropriate for our area. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Next witness, Jeffrey Condit.
This is testimony by 1,000 votes, which will be coming pretty soon.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission, my name is Jeffrey Condit, and I'm the Assistant County Counsel of Benton County. I'm here representing Benton County Commissioners Charlene Carr and Dale Schrock. We have carefully reviewed SB 237. While we've approved recognition of the marginal lands concept, we have grave doubts about the legitimacy, relevancy, and workability of the standards used in the bill to implement this concept. Perhaps our greatest concern is with the tripart standard for determining marginal land contained in Section 2B of the bill. The first requirement is that land, quote, did not make significant contribution to a farm operation that produced $20,000 or more in gross income in three of the 5 years preceding the effective date of this 1983 Act. completely aside from the large amount of legal fees that will be generated by attorneys in defining what the term significant contribution really means, any use of an income test for determining productivity of farmland should be viewed by this committee as inherently suspect. The Land Conservation and Development Commission has specifically rejected this type of test in their Goal 3 administrative rule, in which they state, quote, profitability or gross farm income shall not be considered in determining whether land is agricultural land. We believe that LCDC rejected this type of test because there are too many variables involved in income to make such a test objective and quantifiable, and further, because many of these variables have nothing to do with the productive capabilities of a particular parcel. Examples of the latter include weather, inflation, market conditions, type of crop, and farmer competence. Applying a blanket $20,000 income test to all farms, all farmers, all crops in all areas of the state becomes so completely arbitrary as to render the standard meaningless. Speaking from the perspective of county government, the jurisdiction responsible for administering this bill, this standard would be an administrative nightmare to apply at retail. Each parcel of land zoned marginal land would have to be justified by a five-year income study. Just the logistics of this study would be onerous. Further, we would be completely dependent on the cooperation and goodwill of the landowner, as much of the evidence of farm income is confidential. The second clause of the three-part definition of marginal land requires such land to be in an area of not less than 100 acres, of which at least 50% is composed of contiguous ownerships that are 20 acres or less. How is this somewhat Byzantine standard arrived at? Given how extensively this requirement has been changed during the gestation period of SB 237, one suspects that this is another standard arrived at arbitrarily, without any basis in existing Oregon agricultural land use. We have serious doubts whether any parcel of land presently zoned EFU in Benton County could meet this standard. If such a standard was proposed in a county comprehensive plan, LCDC would reject it out of hand unless it was supported by an extensive background report demonstrating its validity and utility in conjunction with the existing agricultural enterprise in the county. We submit that the legislature should demand no less than LCDC, especially considering that you are attempting to establish a standard based on lot size for the entire state. Again, we must point out that LCDC has specifically refused to establish a statewide agricultural minimum lot size due to the impracticality of determining a lot size that would be valid for all farming operations in all parts of the state. The last of the three standards, which is an alternative to the former standard, requires that the parcel be located in a 100-acre area predominantly of agricultural class 5 and above soils. In Western Oregon, Goal 3 only requires Class 1 through 4 soils to be zoned exclusive farm use. Thus, there are few agricultural lands in Western Oregon which are of lesser soil quality than Class 4 and virtually none in the Willamette Valley. What this provision appears to be telling Western Oregon counties is that marginal land type uses are not legitimate agricultural uses in Western Oregon. This again appears to violate presently held LCDC policy supporting these types of uses. One wonders whether any resource land in Oregon could meet these tests combined. The Governor's Land Use Task Force found that, quote, competition among existing and potential uses of agricultural and forest resources land increases as Oregon works to achieve maximum economic potential. The state's concern for protecting agricultural lands must be weighed with other concerns now. Competing needs must be balanced more equitably in rural Oregon. Oregon's diverse agricultural lands are able to produce food, feed, forage, and fiber. But Goal 3, as now applied, is too inflexible to accommodate this diversity. Perhaps instead of creating another zoning classification such as marginal lands with its attendant additional administrative burden on local governments and the likely effect it will have of encouraging litigation and slowing the acknowledgement and review process, the task force recommendation is better met simply by recognizing that marginal land type uses and a multiplicity of other food, feed, fiber, and forage operations are legitimate agricultural uses in EFU zones and remove the prejudice against those uses that exists in current law. LCDC recognizes the importance of these uses to agriculture in its Goal 3 administrative rule. A perusal of case law, however, indicates that these uses are extremely difficult to establish in practice and that the present interpretation of Goal 3 is geared largely to the benefit of established and conventional larger full-time farms and farming corporations. We believe that this is the inflexible application of Goal 3 that is referred to by the task force. Unfortunately, SB 237, as now written, offers only the illusion of flexibility. Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Chair? The chair of the task force that you refer to disagrees with your opinion. It was my understanding that he appeared before the Senate Environment and Energy Committee and endorsed the concept and thought that that did meet the concern of the task force. Would you like to straighten out what appears to be a discrepancy between your interpretation of the task force recommendation and the chairman's interpretation?
Well, I believe that everybody practically is in agreement that some sort of marginal lands type bill must be worked out in order to provide additional flexibility. I think that perhaps the chairman of that committee, Stafford Hansel, was supporting the concept. My concern as a county governor or a county official who is going to have to be in the trenches implementing this bill is that the standards that we are provided with here are so arbitrary and difficult for us to administer that what's actually going to happen is very little of this land will ever be found, even if it is legitimately marginal land based on productivity. And so this is perhaps the key disagreement we have with this bill.
Not sure that answered the question.